It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And many events this past week worth noting, including, as I said earlier, the dandelions in the schoolyard that were at their seed point. Also in the schoolyard, a plant that I and the students have been watching are the hawthorns. And the hawthorns are still have a little bit of fruit on them. And speaking of fruit on plants, I was down in the Twin Cities over the weekend, and coming back from Minneapolis up Highway 65 down in the McGregor area, there was quite a patch of winterberry or northern holly right along the highway that was just absolutely stunningly scarlet. It caught my eye from at least a quarter mile out, and I could just see this bright red on the side of the road, and I thought, that's northern holly. And sure enough, as we passed it, it was indeed a great patch of northern holly. I mentioned too that the trailing arbutus is quite green. The kids from the North Shore Community School had noted that strawberries and bunchberries are still quite green. That's also true. There's a big sort of leafy plant that looks a little bit like a kind of a giant dandelion. And it is called agrimony, and it stays green through the winter. And of course, there's that crested wood fern, Dryopteris cristata, that is green through the winter. So lots of green out there. Even now, with no snow on the ground, it's pretty easy to see a lot of that very green stuff. Among the greens, the round-branched ground pine, also known colloquially and locally as princess pine. And its scientific name is Lycopodium dendroideum. And this one, it's part of the daily phenology note that you will hear at different times during KAXE's broadcast day today. But I talk a little bit about having spoken with Welby Smith, one of the state's top biologists, botanists, and talking about harvesting princess pine. And Welby is of the opinion that if you're going to build a wreath, use some other product. Don't use the princess pine, because if you go after the princess pine and you start pulling it up, especially if you're pulling it up to get it, you're going to rip the roots out of the ground, and ultimately you'll be destroying the colony. So better that you should just leave it be. And it is also worth noting that it's illegal to pick any wildflower without the permission of the landowner. So if you're on state, county, or federal lands, you're not going to get that permission. And if you're on private lands, you need to talk to the person who owns the land as to whether or not they would appreciate you taking materials off of their property. So check that out before you get too far into it. And maybe you want to find a wreath made from something less expendable than the princess pine. Among the birds, a couple of notes about birds this week. First, I had my first red poles, and I had an American goldfinch. I've also had quite a number of chickadees, and Ed Dallas and I have been talking at length about chickadees and the impossibility of counting them. I don't know how anyone could possibly count chickadees, because they all look the same and they show up at such random numbers and in such random ways that I think it would be impossible to know that you hadn't counted one already. But I happened to be walking by my window the other day, and there was a blue jay on the feeder, and all the chickadees were waiting for Mr. Blue Jay to get done eating. And I have this little rose bush that's roughly the size of a chair. I mean, imagine a sort of a three-dimensional volume sort of equivalent to a desk chair. That little rose bush had 9 chickadees in it, and I was reaching for my camera when the blue jay left and all the chickadees dispersed to get their chance at the seeds, so I couldn't get quite a picture of it, but there were 9 of them in that tree, in that rose bush, and probably a good deal more hanging about nearby. One of our students this morning talked about squirrels and seeing the detritus of squirrels eating red pine cones. And I mentioned that back in August, the squirrels were busy cutting these cones green off of the Norway pines or red pines and stashing them here and there. And I have several of these stashes around my house. And then the squirrels come, pick up a cone or two and chew the bracts off and eat the seeds. And they are doing that big time just about anywhere you go. Wherever I walk in the woods, if I'm in or near a woods that has Norway pine, red pines in it, I'll find a stump or a blown down tree or some other place where the squirrel has elected to do his feeding. And these middens that they create are these piles of cones are kept kind of moist by being in close proximity to one another, and that prevents them from opening up, because if the cones dry out and open up, the seeds will fall out of the cones, and if the seeds fall out of the cones, the squirrels are kind of lost. They don't realize that they can just go dig through the pile and try to find the seeds. They get kind of crazy and think that there's no more seeds available because the cones are open and empty. Back to the birds. I saw a red-tailed hawk when I was down in the cities. That's about the northern edge of their wintertime range. And so oftentimes when I travel to the cities, I'm treated to a sight of a red-tailed hawk. I scared a barred owl off of a Norway pine yesterday. And I have a resident pair by my house, so I get a chance to see them fairly often. And a snowy owl reported on the website on the KAXE KBXE Season Watch page in Cohasset. So that's and a snowy owl in Duluth on their Duluth phenology page. So a few snowy owls in the area. Always exciting to see one of those. I wait for my opportunity. It's been it's too long to count now. I'm trying to think. It was probably I was in my teens when I last saw my snowy owl. So it'll be an exciting day when I get to see one. And I'm going to have to get out and maybe chase that one down in Cohasset. I don't know. The other note that I have today, two of them really, and one from John Guida, who's a rural mail carrier in the Nisswa area, and he said, went for a bog walk this past Sunday, saw and photographed pitcher plants. Have you ever come across information about how long individual pitcher plants' leaves, tubes, live? Not the whole plant. A quick Google search did not reveal much. And I read Chell Anderson's chapter on pitcher plants in her book, The North Shore, and there wasn't much in there about the life of the leaf other than the fact that the insects that use the leaves as a breeding ground, there's one particular mosquito that can lay its eggs in that very acidic water that's in that pitcher plant and not have the acids just dissolve the egg or the nymph that comes from the egg. And that mosquito always lays its eggs in brand new fresh leaves. So they want a leaf that's going to, because the mosquito larvae has to live in there for a whole year, they want a leaf that's not going to crack open at some point and have the water leak out, because that would be disastrous for the mosquitoes. So, and our final note this week comes from, Joe Adams, who was the discoverer, and Steve Young, who was kind enough to send me the information. Steve and Joe are both in the Bemidji area, and Joe lives up on the Mississippi River where it comes out of Lake Bemidji. And Joe had been skating on the ice or walking on the ice near his home, and he discovered in the shallow waters a great number of snapping turtles, and they took some pictures, and it turned out that there were not only snapping turtles but painted turtles in there as well. And so I was prompted to go out to a person by the name of Susan Kynast, who did research on snapping turtles in the state of Maine and had some great information about snapping turtles. And this is what she had to say about snapping turtles. in their hibernation. In the winter, snapping turtles hibernate in shallow water, buried in the mud, in places which do not freeze to the bottom, usually in groups. During that time, their body temperature is reduced to about 34 degrees Fahrenheit, just above freezing. If the temperature drops further, the turtles can freeze to death or be killed by the forming ice. During this time, they hardly move, although some have been observed moving under the ice. Hibernating snapping turtles do not breathe for, in the northern part of their range, more than 6 months. Since ice covers their hibernating site. While snapping turtles can get oxygen by pushing their head and throat out of the mud and allowing gas exchange to take place through the membranes of their mouth and throat, this is known as extrapulmonary respiration. If they cannot get enough oxygen through this method, they start to utilize anaerobic pathways, burning sugars and fats without the use of oxygen. The metabolic byproducts of this process are acidic and create very undesirable side effects by spring, which are known as oxygen debt. Hibernating snapping turtles are also very vulnerable to predators since they cannot move enough to defend themselves. At the site of the long-term study of snapping turtles in Algonquin Park, Ontario, the whole population of snapping turtles was effectively exterminated during a single winter when otters ate the viscera out of the hibernating and defenseless turtles. While some snapping turtles are still moving around a little at the beginning of October, they will all have moved to their hibernating areas by mid-October. Some individuals have hibernacula within their home range, but about 50% have hibernacula outside of their home range, to which they travel up to 2.5 miles. They then return to their home territory in the spring. Hibernating sites have to offer some access to either dissolved or atmospheric oxygen to prevent serious oxygen debt by spring. In areas where ice forms, hibernating areas need to be deep enough so they don't freeze to the bottom. About 50% of the turtles choose to hibernate again at sites where they have previously overwintered, although not necessarily the previous year. Turtles often switch between different types of hibernacula from year to year, but have a favorite site of each type to which to return again and again. Even if individuals change their summer home range, they will still return to their hibernacula, but there are only a few favorite sites in each body of water. So many snapping turtles aggregate and hibernate literally in a pile together, staying less than 2 meters away from the other turtles and often stacked directly on top of each other. While the exact reasons for the group hibernating behavior is unclear, it unfortunately exposes them to predation by otters. Males hibernate on top of females, so it is possible that they serve to protect the females from both predation and the environment, such as thickening ice. In some areas where ponds are temporary, snapping turtles must just bury in the mud during summer. As water levels rise and fall and temperatures drop, they simply continue to hibernate until spring. A great deal of information in Susan Kynast's report on snapping turtles, including this, which I thought was really interesting, because a lot of people believe that snapping turtles are responsible for a lot of predation of baby loons and baby ducks. And she had this to say about that. Despite what people say, there has never been any record of a snapping turtle eating a loon, and extraordinarily extensive studies were undertaken right here in Maine examining this question. We should always keep in mind that snapping turtles and waterfowl have coexisted in some cases millions of years before the advent of man, and that there is no reason to expect that snappers will suddenly exterminate them. In fact, they may play an important role in the prevention of the spread of disease from sick ducklings. So even though you may have heard otherwise, ducks, ducklings, and loons make a very, very tiny portion of the snapping turtle's diet. So lots of information about snapping turtles. This hibernacula that Joe Adams discovered contained 85 snapping turtles that he was able to count, plus numerous painted turtles that were in amongst the snappers. So interesting things going on in the Mississippi River. That's our phenology show for this week. I hope that you will keep your eyes open, and if you have information to share, please send it along.